present here in the room are Representative Kopp, my vice chair, Representative Shaw, online are Representative Ledoux, and Representative Stutes, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Also listening online, I would recognize Senator Giesel is online, as is Speaker Edgman, and Representative LeBond has also joined online. I will do my best to keep track of people that come online. Before we begin, I want to thank Jordan May, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time I'd remind committee members and those in the room to silence your cell phones, and I would urge those online to please mute your line unless you want to, representatives want to be have a chance to be heard. You should just speak up, and I will call on you in due course. We have two guests that will be testifying today, I believe, calling in to testify, and a third that was invited, but it appears they won't be attending. We have Megan Wallace, the Director of Legislative Legal Services, will be joining us today. Kate Vogel, who's the Anchorage Municipal Attorney, and we did send invitations to the Attorney General's office, but at this point it appears they won't be joining us today. The first person we'll actually open for invited testimony, and we're going to start with questions relating to the CARES Act funding. I think members of the committee and I had distributed a number of questions, and the first person who will testify will be Kate Vogel, who's the Anchorage Municipal Attorney. I would note that part of the reason that I had asked Ms. Vogel to provide testimony today was because at one of the earlier hearings that I was attending, the municipality indicated that they took a more expansive view of what they could use CARES Act funding for, and so I thought it would be helpful if we could hear from the city attorney and they could provide some background. What I've asked Ms. Vogel to do, she'll make a short introductory statement, and then she'll go through the first list of questions regarding CARES Act funding that is on the pages that I've provided. And then after she's gone through those various questions and made her presentation, then we'll open it up for questions. And then after she finishes, we'll hear from Megan Wallace. I would note that Representative Vance has also joined us, and Jason Bakkenstadt, who's the Chief of Staff for the Mayor of Anchorage, is also on the line. Ms. Vogel, can you hear us okay?
Representative Klayman, yes, I can. Thank you.
And if you want to make a short opening, and then if you want to work your way through the questions, I would note these questions were my office prepared the questions to the extent that this through a research project your way late yesterday afternoon, and you didn't have time to do full research on it. We're not going to expect you to answer things you're not prepared to respond to, but if you want to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to the House Judiciary Committee today. I'm here in part to confirm that Anchorage has reached the conclusion that it will be able to spend CARES Act money that is given to us. And the latest FAQs from Treasury that were issued on Monday, which supplement the Treasury's guidance on how to spend CARES Act funds, are particularly useful in that regard. Specifically, the FAQs clarify that the fund is designed to provide ready funding to address unforeseen financial needs, which, of course, Anchorage and the rest of the state have experienced, and states that for this reason, and as a matter of administrative convenience, in light of the emergency nature of this program, a state, territorial, local, or tribal government may presume that payroll costs for public health and public safety employees are payments for services substantially dedicated to mitigating or responding to the COVID-19 public health emergency. To us, this is a clear statement from Treasury that our payroll that is dedicated to these first responders and to our health officials is something that CARES Act money can fund, and therefore we will be able to fully utilize the CARES Act funding. Some of the questions that I have been asked today, as Anchorage's municipal attorney, I'm either not at complete liberty to give an answer to, given that I don't share an attorney-client relationship with this committee, and that obviously we're not even in executive session if we did, and some of them may hinge on sort of imagined or future litigation that I just don't think that it benefits the municipality to speculate about. That said, to the extent that I can be helpful, I'm happy to. And with that, I'm prepared to go through the questions that have been that were written down, if that is what the committee would like.
Yes, if so, you could proceed with the questions that we provided in advance.
I sure will. So one of those is the language of the CARES Act consistent with the Treasury's interpretation? And what I would respond is that the language of the CARES Act is not as restrictive as the Treasury's interpretation, which might not be the same thing as calling it inconsistent. But it certainly has interesting implications for how strictly the Treasury's guidance should be interpreted and how many limits should be inferred from it. As I said, I think we in Anchorage are perfectly able to fit squarely within Treasury's guidance with its latest FAQ update, but nonetheless, before this FAQ update, we were certainly looking at how binding is Treasury guidance, and that's one of the issues to get to in a moment.
And thank you. Just for a brief interruption, Representative Ortiz joined us online at about 10:03, and Representative Josephson has joined us here in the conference room in Anchorage. Please proceed.
Thank you. So the CARES Act itself, an enormous act, only has three lines about the use of funds for state, tribal governments, and units of local governments. And the three requirements are we can use the funds to cover only those costs that are necessary expenditures incurred due to the public health emergency, were not accounted for in the budget most recently approved as of the date of the CARES Act passage, and were incurred during the period that begins March 1st, 2020 and ends on December 30th, 2020. So that is not particularly expansive language, and therefore the Treasury guidance, which uses a lot more words to spell that out, is certainly adding some things that were not in the law itself. And the Treasury guidance provides explanation about the definition of an expenditure that is due to the current public health emergency and what not accounted for in the budget means. That guidance is not taking the most expansive view of the CARES Act itself, and I think that's what has prompted so much outcry from senators who were involved in drafting the CARES Act. And so we've seen a really unusual, at least from my limited experience, number of senators writing in and requesting more expansive and permissive guidance to effectuate congressional intent. And the letter that the committee has from Senators Reid and Schumer and signed by 46 senators in total says a plain text reading of the law leads to the logical conclusion that lost or delayed revenues are a direct cost created by the coronavirus that were never accounted for in any budget. And Senator Murkowski and a total of 16 senators also wrote to Treasury urging that direct emergency payments from states to units of local government should be eligible expenses based on the intent of Congress when it passed the CARES Act. So in this sense, the fact that the guidance doesn't include either of those phrases that are as permissive is an indication that that guidance is a bit cramped. So I say that even though I think Anchorage will be able to fully spend its CARES Act money consistent with Treasury's interpretation. I was also asked if the legislative history of the CARES Act is consistent with Treasury's interpretation, and I'm going to give the frank answer that I have not reviewed the entire sum total of the legislative history on the CARES Act, some of which is not fully compiled, like the hearing transcripts aren't as easy to find. But in my look through the congressional record, I've found that most speakers don't delve into detail on revenue replacement, for example, but they do certainly discuss this as providing the needed relief for state and local governments. And my favorite portion of the congressional record is from March 27, 2020, the congressional record at H-1852 from Congresswoman DeLauro. And I'm going to just quote a brief passage from her congressional record testimony, which stated, with state revenues collapsing at the same time demand for services is skyrocketing, we have had broad agreement that something needs to be done to help the states. Although some might have preferred to increase the federal matching rate for Medicaid, this legislation goes a different route with a fiscal relief fund for state and local governments. In any case, the key is to help states plug the enormous fiscal gaps they are currently facing. I am pleased that the final legislative language, unlike some earlier proposals that we rejected, gives states broad flexibility in how they spend the money they will receive. At this point, it has become impossible to separate the effects on state budgets of rising demands for services and shortfalls in revenues. States cannot spend the money on new projects unrelated to the public health emergency and its economic fallout. I doubt any state would have done that anyway, but the legislation clearly says that they cannot. Beyond that, we trust states' discretion about what expenditures are necessary in light of the current crisis. We also know that states planned many expenditures assuming revenues that they are no longer receiving. An activity without the revenue to support it is not accounted for in the state's budget. The state should understand that they can apply this money to prevent the cuts that would devastate their necessary functions that they can no longer cover from their general funds because of the loss of sales and income tax revenues. We are assured that the Treasury Department appreciates the importance of getting this money out to states quickly, flexibly, and with a bare minimum of paperwork. And so I find that obviously to be exactly the sort of statement that we would want to see in the legislative history, and that broad and expansiveness is not fully embedded, unfortunately, within Treasury's guidance. I was also asked whether federal courts apply a different standard for statutory interpretation than Alaska courts. I'm going to give the Cliff Notes version on what the differences are. They aren't exactly the same. So the Alaska Supreme Court has a sliding scale approach to looking at legislative history, and the plainer the language, the more convincing legislative history would need to be to the contrary in order to be a factor in interpreting a law. And federal courts, by contrast, appear to adopt the principle that if the plain meaning of the statute is unambiguous on its face, then the legislative history should not be looked at all. Of course, this is to some extent a matter of judicial philosophy, and so I wouldn't call it a hard and fast rule or a prediction for how any particular court would rule. I've also asked the question, how does the federal standard affect analysis of the CARES Act provision? And any legal battle over interpreting the CARES Act provision would be done in federal court. And so therefore, arguably, the plain language of the CARES Act should matter more and legislative history should matter less than if this was being decided in a state court in Alaska. But I don't think that gives us a ton of guidance on exactly what a court would do when faced with a particularly an unknown question in front of it. And then there's a question about how much deference do courts give to Treasury's interpretation of the CARES Act? The answer is that that also varies based on the situation. There are two types of deference that are possibly relevant to this discussion or that I've been asked about. One is Chevron deference, which is a deference principle that if a statute is silent or ambiguous on a specific issue, there should be deference to the agency's interpretation so long as it is a permissible or reasonable construction. So that's quite a bit of deference within many ambiguous possibilities. If the agency has picked one that is reasonable, Chevron deference would say that therefore controls. And there's another type of deference which is much less used and more recently on the scene, that is Skidmore deference. That requires a lesser degree of deference than Chevron deference and would say that the agency's interpretation is due the deference essentially due the deference that is due to its persuasiveness. So it's persuasive authority rather than controlling if it is reasonable. In this case, I've asked which standard would likely apply to an interpretation of the CARES Act. I'm not sure that I can give you a full answer on that one, but probably Skidmore deference. I mean, it would really, I may be speaking beyond what's fully fair to say, given that I'm not sure what the case would look like, but Chevron deference is normally used for an agency decision that's followed particular processes, like public notice and comment. So the more weighty administrative decisions, and Skidmore deference is due to agency interpretations or agency actions that are shy of that standard. So since this is just guidance and guidance is not binding by law, there's certainly a good argument that this shouldn't receive Chevron deference in this case. I was also asked the question, if there is a problem with the statutory language or the legislative history, what options does Congress have to fix the problem and clarify whether states and local governments may use the funds to replace lost revenue? The CARES Act expressly delegated to Treasury the authority to determine whether payments are used for eligible purposes, but that determination needs to be consistent with the statutory language. I think we've seen a response from Congress members, which is to write to Treasury to try to shape and clarify the guidance that Treasury has issued. That's obviously one option that they're pursuing as experts in the federal system because they think it's an effective way to achieve the results that states and local governments need to get the CARES Act language properly interpreted. Obviously, Congress also has the power to write new laws, change laws. And beyond that, I don't know enough about the other federal options that might be available to meaningfully opine. I was asked how much weight courts would likely give to state legislative findings about the appropriate scope for CARES Act funding. I'm having trouble imagining the scenario in which a federal court is giving weight to that as they are interpreting what the Congress intended when they passed the CARES Act. So possibly in a lawsuit that I haven't imagined the contours of, this is relevant, but I'm not sure that it impacts the meaning of the CARES Act itself. I was asked, if a dispute arises between the state of Alaska and the federal government concerning state or local government expenditures, how would they resolve that dispute? The CARES Act delegates to the Treasury the authority to determine whether payments are used for eligible purposes. I'm not familiar with the process that they would use to communicate with us if they believe that there was a problem. There is a provision in the law that if the state, tribal government, or local unit of government has failed to comply with the proper spending for the proper purposes, an amount equal to the amount of funds used in violation of such subsection shall be booked as a debt owed to the federal government. I think that provision of the law also answers the next question I was asked, which is, who is responsible for repayment to the federal government for improper expenditures of CARES Act funding. The next question is, if the local government spends improperly, is the state responsible for repayment? I think the answer would be different if payments were being made directly from Congress or from Treasury to local governments, because no local governments in Alaska met the threshold for that size. I think Treasury's interaction with the state over government CARES Act funds is going to be directly with the state. The statute only seems to contemplate distribution to and recoupment from larger cities, the state, and tribal governments. So that's sort of Treasury's response. And then there's the question that I was asked, which is, if the state repays the federal government, can the state seek reimbursement from the local government? And I am unable to answer that one. I can't speculate without knowing what the facts were of that situation. That reaches the end of the questions that I was asked to speak about.
Thank you very much. I would note Representative Drummond has joined us, which means the Community Regional Affairs Committee has completed their work, and I got a note on my phone that Representative Sponholz is also listening in, although she doesn't appear on the roster. I think she must be watching, not on the off-net. This opens up for questions for Ms. Vogel. Does anyone... either anybody on the committee have questions for Ms. Vogel? I don't see Representative Kopp signaling or Representative Shaw. Does any of the committee members online have questions for Ms. Vogel?
I have one.
Representative Kopp, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Vogel, is there any area of shortfall that the Muni has experienced tied to COVID-19 that the Muni is waiting for an answer on from Treasury? I'm thinking of our significant homeless camp cleanups amid the COVID-19 pandemic, and also all of our municipal employees involved with being in and among the camps, and I know that there's a lot of work that has to go on under greater expense because of the precautions taken. Are those difficult to recover? What is the municipal's take on that?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, we believe that the latest FAQs on this, which allow us to fund payroll for our public safety responders, mean that that the guidance is very clear that we can spend the money that we need to spend. So at this point, we're not concerned that the current guidance prevents us from spending any CARES Act money we receive. I don't know if that quite answers the question. I agree that we've experienced significant increased costs. But the fact that we are able to pay for payroll presumptively of our first responders means that we believe we can fully utilize CARES Act funding.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the CARES Act funding covers the time period March 1st, 2020 through December 30, 2020. Do municipalities or the state, as far as you know, have the ability to save any of those funds based on continuing impacts? We know that this pandemic has both the short-term and long-term, but still directly attributable. I would point to all the synergies between the public sector and the private sector that have to work together in concert, and we know that we're going to see a tapering off of this for some time. Is the municipality allowed to save any monies beyond that period, or do they all have to be encumbered in some way before the end of this year?
through the chair, Representative Cobb, I don't know that I know the answer to that. When I look at the law, it says that the funds can be used to cover costs that were incurred between March 1st and December 30th, 2020. But that, to me, doesn't say that that the money needs to, again, leave the municipality. It's covering costs that were incurred during this period as opposed to costs being incurred next year. But once we receive the funds, I anticipate I don't see it speaking to that, but I do have Jason Bockenstedt, the chief of staff to Mayor Berkowitz, on the line, and he may be able to provide some additional answer to your question.
Thank you.
Mr. Bockenstedt, do you have a supplement? Can you supplement Ms. Vogel's answer on that question?
I can. Thank you very much, through the chair, Representative Kopp. In the most recent FAQ update that Treasury released earlier this week, that was an exact question that they answered, which was, do governments have to return unspent funds to Treasury? And what they say is, if a government has not used the funds it has received to cover costs that were incurred by December 30th, as required, those funds must be returned to the Department of Treasury. So I read that as if you encumber them or are using them before December 30th, you can certainly use them past December 30th, but if there are still funds that you have not used, anything past December 30th, it appears, would need to be returned.
Okay, through the chair. Follow-up? Thank you, Jason. I appreciate that. So if you have a specific administrative agency, Jason, that you can see going into this next year will have a continuing shortfall due to projected expenses that will be related to COVID-19, are you able to estimate in advance what those will be and consider those funds encumbered? I'm trying to envision scenarios where the municipality facing a dramatic reduction in revenue, would be looking at either raising taxes locally or dramatically cutting services. But if you could have an expenditure plan in advance where funds are encumbered that could be tied directly back to COVID-19 going into this next year, is that allowed, or are you I'm not quite sure if you said they actually have to be an expense plan that concludes by December 30, or as long as they were encumbered for that purpose, you could spend it into this next year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Scott, that's a great question, and I think just based on what the statute says and what the guidance says is that, to answer your specific question, if we have further expenses that begin on January 1st, the answer, I think, is clearly no. We would not be able to use these funds for any purpose or any issues that we have beginning on January 1st, 2021. We would have to hope that there would be additional federal funding that would come in some subsequent stimulus package.
Mr.
Cobb. Representative Cobb, comment on that. Go ahead. This is not a question, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Jason, if you want to respond to this. So my thought, and maybe the state is in a position to advocate, it's hard to see over the horizon, and I think forcing the state or a municipal entity to expend all the money within a very tight timeline could result in less than prudent, certainly less than ideal, when you just can't know the future of how this is all going to play out. And it would seem to me that if the requirement was loosened to where the mandate of it being spent by a drop-dead date, for lack of a better term, or at least allowing into this next year, would prevent municipalities from all of a sudden having a dramatic drop in stimulus as well as dramatic drop in revenue, because we know it will take some time for the economy to recover, that the ability to manage these funds into this next year for COVID-19 related, and this gets into the loss of revenue, Mr. Chairman, thinking that maybe there's some advocacy that we need to do for the state in that regard with our delegation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux has a question. Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
Okay, unmute myself. Thank you. So I want to see if I understand this. If you know you have an expense that is going to be incurred in the future, could you actually prepay under the current guidelines or the current laws, as opposed to actually prepay it so that it would be encumbered or it would be spent, but it's not something for between now and December 30th?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't believe so. I believe the statute is pretty clear when it says that these expenditures have to have been incurred between, I believe it's March 1st, 2020, and December 31st, 2020. So I don't see a ton of wiggle room there to say, well, we're going to prepay something that happens in January or February of 2021, but I will defer maybe to Kate and see if she has a different read on that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, no, I see it the same way, and I hadn't remembered that extra guidance about clawing back if about not using the funds. I think that's the Treasury speaking more expansively than the statute, but the statute definitely, clearly in the plain language of it itself, says the costs need to be incurred during the period that begins on March 1st, 2020, and ends on December 30th, 2020.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just note, it doesn't completely solve the problem, but I'm looking at the first page of the frequently asked questions from Treasury, and I think it's the third, I guess it's the second question down, and they say in there that state, territorial, local, or tribal government may presume that payroll costs for public health and public safety employees are payments for services substantially dedicated to mitigating or responding to COVID-19. That would appear to me to mean that, for example, Anchorage could use the COVID money to basically pay the entire police and fire payroll for the year, and they may be able to save some of the other money to use in the following year if they used it all in the current year. And I would assume apply to public health employees. Do you read that as meaning they could use the funds to pay the entire payroll for the public safety employees as well as public health employees during the period in question?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we read the FAQ to state that.
So are there other questions from members of the committee for either Mr. Bakkenstadt or Ms. Vogel? I don't see anyone here seeking. I don't see any texts making that question, and I don't hear anybody asking further questions. So I want to thank both Ms. Vogel and Ms. Bakkenstadt for being available today. Next invited testimony is from Megan Wallace, who's the director of our Legislative Legal Services. Ms. Wallace, good morning, and what I would ask that you do is, if you want to go through the first set of questions regarding the CARES Act, then we'll take questions about the CARES Act, and after we finish that, then we'll go through the questions about the RPL process, and take questions about the RPL process. And to the extent that you're largely in agreement with what we've heard from Ms. Vogel as well as Mr. Bakenstadt, you don't necessarily need to go at the same level of detail in the areas they've already discussed that you're in agreement with. Ms. Wallace.
Good morning. Thank you. For the record, Megan Wallace, Director of Legal Services. I guess I will start by just noting that I did go through the same list of topics and questions, and I focused most of my attention to the RPL process. And while I'm familiar with the CARES Act, I did not have enough time to do any extensive research on the federal interpretation issues, and I am satisfied that Ms. Vogel satisfactorily and sufficiently answered the questions that were posed on that list. And so to the extent that anyone would like me to weigh in on a particular topic, I'm satisfied that we can move on to the RPL process. But I'll pause to see if anyone would like to ask my viewpoint on any of the issues that Ms. Vogel just went through with the committee.
Any members of the committee that have questions for Ms. Wallace with regard to the CARES Act funding and the potential for replacing less revenue? Representative Topp.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Go ahead, Representative Topp, please.
Ms. Wallace, thank you for being here. So Ms. Vogel made it pretty clear that her understanding is the state would be the liable entity for a misappropriation of funds. Due to the nature of how the money is coming to the state from Treasury in one stimulus of $1.25 billion, and because we have no municipal entities large enough to qualify as an eligible recipient for a single appropriation, therefore the state is the only qualified entity to receive it. So the committee heard that the state is liable for misappropriation, not the municipality. Is that also your understanding? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, yeah, that would be my general understanding. So the money that is coming in for the CARES Act for Alaska has been deposited into the state's treasury account. So the money will be dispersed to local governments from the state's from the state account to the different local governments. And the guidance that Treasury has given the states says that, yes, the states are, you know, one of the acceptable uses of the funds is to disperse those funds to local governments to be spent, but that the local governments are still bound by the use of fund provisions in the CARES Act. In other words, you can send the money to the local governments, but the local governments still need to use the funds in the manner prescribed in the CARES Act that Ms. Vogel went through in terms of, you know, to be used to cover costs associated with the public health emergency. And so if as part of the CARES Act, there is some oversight authority from the Inspector General of the Department of Treasury, and what I suspect is that, you know, if there is some kind of audit or oversight, you know, the records of, you know, what the state did with the money in terms of dispersing it to the local government on top of, you know, examining how the local government spent that money. But because the federal government sent the money to the state, I suspect, and although, you know, we don't know the particular facts and circumstances at this point, I suspect that it would be the state that's liable for repayment, not necessarily the local government. And just depending on the scenario in which the funds are dispersed, the state may have some opportunity to try to collect the funds back from the local government. But again, that's very speculative, just depending on the circumstance of how it gets distributed.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So would that be true, Megan, even if the state had no reason to think that the municipality was using the money improperly? I mean, how much of a micromanaging is the state expected to do with this municipal money? I mean, can it just give the money to the municipalities, and as long as the municipalities aren't saying in advance, we're going to use it for X, Y, or Z improper purpose? Or are you following me there?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, I am. I think that goes to my comments about, you know, it just depends on the facts and circumstances. Certainly, it would be my recommendation that when the state disperses these funds, that, you know, local governments are, you know, put on specific notice in terms of the expectation of expenditure of these funds, and that they are be expended in accordance with, you know, Treasury guidance and according to the CARES Act. But, you know, what we don't know the answer to your specific question, meaning if the state does that due diligence, you know, should it be responsible for repaying those funds? Those are just issues that have not yet been resolved, or additional guidance hasn't come down yet, and maybe that is forthcoming. You know, this is obviously a very evolving scenario. As Ms. Vogel pointed out, the FAQs that were distributed to committee members, those latest set of FAQs came out on Monday. There's mounting pressure from, you know, states across the country, governors, other organizations, local governments for the guidance to be broadened to allow for specific revenue replacement. So, you know, to be honest, I don't think this is the last word we're going to hear in terms of guidance on use and eventually oversight of the CARES Act. And I think part of the reason we probably aren't hearing the guidance on the consequences of misuse is because people are first trying to understand how they can use it and get it dispersed. And money, not only in Alaska, but in other states, hasn't necessarily made it to local governments yet.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Representative Ledoux, go ahead. I just can't tell. There's no way to tell whether you want to, so go ahead.
You can just assume it.
Well, it wasn't true last time, so that's why I have to be patient.
I'm just kidding. Okay. So I'm just could the state get the municipalities to sign in advance before the money goes to them, hold harmless agreements? And I mean, obviously, maybe with some of the municipalities, they wouldn't have the money, you know, it might not be worth the paper that it's written on, but with other larger municipalities, it might very well be. Would that be an option for the state?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you know, it's hard to opine on that kind of off the cuff, but my initial reaction would be that if the state wanted to ensure some kind of hold harmless agreement, it would be my recommendation that the legislature consider a substantive law provision kind of outlining what the criteria and expectation would be. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in codified law. It could be, you know, uncodified temporary law, similar to, you know, the language that was in SB 241 on the disaster to set forth that expectation, and then have some legal recourse as opposed to, you know, a gentleman's agreement sort of thing.
No, I wasn't talking actually about a gentleman's agreement sort of thing. I was talking about a signed a signed hold harmless agreement?
Well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not sure at this point that the executive branch has the authority to demand or require a hold harmless agreement before disbursement of those funds, but that's something that I'm happy to look into further.
Thank you.
Any other questions from those that are on the committee that are online? You can either text me or you can just speak up and say you've got a question. I don't hear any. So, Ms. Wallace, if you could then, that I think that gets us through the questions on the CARES Act funding. If you could now go ahead to the questions about the RPL structure and the appropriation authority and go through those questions, and after you've gone through those, then we'll open it up for questions.
Sure. Before I get into the heart of the RPL process and the questions that were posed, for the record, and kind of as a reminder to any members of the public that may be watching or listening to the meeting, my office provides policy-neutral, nonpartisan legal advice. So I just want to make sure that everyone is aware that my comments today on the RPL process or the CARES Act should not be viewed as advocating for or against any particular process for appropriating or expending these CARES Act funds. The legislature has found itself in unprecedented circumstances and has incredibly difficult policy decisions to make as a result of these circumstances. So I just wanted to make sure that was on record before we got into the RPL process, as I know there's a lot of questions about this process going forward. I will move on to I'll start with the list of questions that were posed, and I'm sure there will be more, and I will do my best to answer those. So the first question is regarding the constitutional provisions that establish the legislature's appropriation authority. So Article 9, Section 13 of the Alaska Constitution states that no money shall be withdrawn from the Treasury except in accordance with appropriations made by law. And so the legislature is the body of government that makes those appropriations by law. I will also note that the confinement clause, which is found in Article 2, Section 13, under the form of bills, specifically states that bills for appropriations shall be confined to appropriations. And so what that just means is that you can't commingle substantive law and appropriations into a single bill. But appropriations are not bound by the single subject restrictions that substantive measures are. The next question is about the appropriation authority that the governor has under the Constitution. So the governor has no appropriation power under the Alaska Constitution. The governor does have budget requirements. So under Article 9, Section 12, the governor is required to submit to the legislature a budget for the next fiscal year. And so that is the extent of the governor's budget constitutional obligations. I will add, most people are aware that their Title 37 includes an Executive Budget Act, which outlines additional budget requirements that the executive branch must follow with respect to submission of proposed budgets, revenue measures, and things of that nature. The next question is there a different analysis on the appropriation authority when federal funds are involved, and including, you know, if there is a state matching fund requirement or without a state funding matching requirement? And the answer to that question is basically no. So federal funds are deposited into the state treasury. And so under Article 9, Section 13, those funds cannot be withdrawn from the treasury except in accordance with appropriation. So all of the state's federal receipts are appropriated through the budget process. And that doesn't differ whether or not there's a state matching requirement or without. They're designated general fund matching appropriations are designated so that we know how much the state is spending to match the or to meet that federal match requirement, but the legality or the necessity of appropriating those funds doesn't change whether or not there's a matching requirement or not. The next question was about examples of other program receipts that may involve the RPL process. And to back up just a little bit, the RPL process is set forth in Alaska Statute 3707080H, which I won't read the entire provision, but the lead-in clause says that the increase of an appropriation item based on additional federal or other program receipts not specifically appropriated by the full legislature may be expended in accordance with the following procedures. So that question about other program receipts is with respect to the language there in 3707080H. And as an example of other program receipts, so there is a definition in 3705-146 of program receipts, and subsection A specifically states that in 3705-142 through 146 and 3707080, program receipts means fees, charges, income earned on assets and other state money received by a state agency in connection with performance of its functions. They're also in that section, 3705-146, is a list of, it looks like, about 79 different types of program receipts that are specifically referenced as examples. So in general terms, the RPL process, if a state agency, collected more fees or more revenue than was expected during a regular budget process, the RPL process could be used to increase, that agency's budget to allow them to spend the additional program receipts that it received during the fiscal year that maybe were not anticipated during the regular budget process.
So just by way of example, if we were talking about fishing license receipts and the budget was to get $100,000 in fishing license receipts and they ended up getting $120,000 in fishing license receipts, that would be an example of other program receipts that could be adjusted through the RPL process.
Correct.
Please continue.
Okay. The next question is about the history of the RPL process. So 3707080H was originally enacted in 1977. And as part of the original enactment, both the governor and LBNA needed to explicitly approve the RPL before the expenditure could be made. The language was different than it is now, and I'll read it briefly just to have some context of how the language in 1977 differs than the current language. Back in 1977 when enacted, the provision stated that appropriations may be revised on approval by the governor and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to allow for an increase of an appropriation item based on additional federal or other program receipts, establishment of a new permanent position not authorized in the appropriated operating budget, or reallocation between appropriation items. Following the original enactment of that subsection, a lawsuit was filed challenging the provision, and Judge Tom Stewart of the Juneau Superior Court found that all three types of the revisions was unconstitutional, and he specifically found that the statute was an improper delegation of the legislative power to appropriate to a committee, and it was also a violation of the separation of powers doctrine to the extent that the provision authorized the legislative committee to exercise jointly with the governor's expenditure authority. And so after the that case was litigated, or after the Superior Court decision was reached, the appeal, and the name of that case was Kelly v. Hammond, for anyone who's particularly interested. And Judge Tom Stewart opinion was reached in 1978. But the appeal in that case was dismissed. And so there's little precedential value to that case. And interestingly, after that case was decided, the legislature actually proposed a constitutional amendment to the voters, proposing that budget revisions and expenditure of program receipts upon the approval of the governor and an interim committee be permissible, but the voters rejected the constitutional amendment. So in the session that immediately followed the rejection of the constitutional amendment, the legislature enacted 3707-0808H in substantially the same form that it appears now. So that was enacted in Chapter 60, SLA 1979, and there have been no further challenges to that statute. So other than the Kelly v. Hammond case that was litigated with respect to the old language, there have been no challenges to the RPL statute itself. In most recent litigation history, there was when Governor Walker proposed Medicaid expansion through utilization of the RPL process, that was challenged, but the issue in the Medicaid expansion litigation largely surrounded the interpretation of who was a covered person under the state Medicaid statute and not over the RPL process itself. So there seems to be some confusion in terms of whether or not the RPL process was litigated in that case. I'll pause there in case anyone has any questions.
Any questions, particularly with respect to the history of the RPL statute, the Kelly versus Hammond lawsuit, and the subsequent changes to the statute? How does that compare to the 1977 statute that Judge Stewart found unconstitutional? How did they modify it?
So the main difference between the 1977 version and our current version is that the LBNA committee no longer has the power. The LBNA's consent to the expenditure is no longer explicitly required. So under the new statute, there's a couple key differences. So I think one of the main differences is that under the 1977 version, both the governor and LBNA had to approve the RPL. That the LBNA approval is no longer required. Instead, a 45-day wait period now exists. And so if LBNA does not recommend that the governor move forward with the proposed expenditure, the governor just has to come review the program again and then provide in writing a statement as to why the governor is going to move forward with the expenditures anyways. And so LBNA does not have the power to reject the expenditures like it did under the 1977 provision. The other key difference that I note is that in the current version, it states that an increase of an appropriation item can be made for additional federal or program receipts not specifically appropriated by the full legislature. And so that clause was not in the original provision. And so, it continues to be an increase of an appropriation item already enacted by the full legislature, meaning the RPL process does not allow for new appropriations or revisions to those appropriations. And so LBNA is not being delegated the full appropriation power of the legislature, and now acting in more of an advisory capacity, the issue that Judge Stewart found about an improper delegation to the committee has arguably, been remedied.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
So did Judge Stewart also base his ruling besides on the delegation of powers to the LBNA committee on a separation of powers between the legislature and the governor? And then depending upon what the answer to that is, I may have a follow-up.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's correct. So part of Judge Stewart's opinion was that there was a violation of the separation of powers doctrine to the extent that the provision was allowing the legislative committee to exercise its powers jointly with the governor's expenditure authority.
So
follow-up?
Yeah. So if that was a problem, wouldn't it even be more of a problem that, assuming that Stewart's ruling was correct, that you now have an MBNA committee and statute which exceeded the power after 45 days to the governor, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, a key portion to the RPL process, which we haven't quite gotten to on our list of questions, is also the catch-all appropriation that is contained in, that is always, well, not always, but has traditionally been contained in the operating and even the capital budgets that the legislature authorizes each year. And so the catch-all appropriations, which are contained in the appropriation bills that the full legislature passes, actually appropriates these additional federal and program receipts conditioned on compliance with the RPL process under 3707-080H. And so, it's generally been my opinion that because the legislature has appropriated these receipts conditioned on compliance with the RPL process, that the governor's expenditure of those funds after the 45-day wait period is contemplated as part of the appropriation bills that the legislature passes.
Follow up.
And that's true even if the MB&A committee says we don't want the governor to do this?
Through the chair, correct, because the RPL process or the procedures contemplate that the LBNA committee may recommend against, the language says that, you know, if the LBNA provides that the state should not initiate the additional activity, the governor shall review the program again and then provide a statement as to the reasons they're moving forward. And so the catch-all language in the appropriation bill that I was referencing provides that those additional funds are appropriated conditioned on compliance with 3707-0808. And so in that circumstance where LBNA recommends that the state not move forward, so long as the governor complies with the provision that says that he has to provide a statement for the reasons of moving forward anyways, the process arguably has been satisfied. I will provide the caveat that, you know, there may be disagreement, though, and there historically has been, in terms of whether an RPL that has been submitted by the governor does meet the criteria of the RPL process. And if there's disagreement in terms of whether an increase that the governor is seeking does not comply with 3707-0808, there then could lay a disagreement in terms of whether it's appropriate to move forward with those expenditures anyways, because there ultimately could be a legal disagreement in terms of whether the RPL complied with 3707-0808 in the first place.
So just one more follow-up.
Representative will do.
So it's just, I'm not sure this is a question, it's just sort of hard for me to understand that statute which allows both the governor and the MB&A committee to have to come to an agreement on something, that's an unconstitutional because of the separation of powers. A statute like the current one basically says, well, you know, tough LBNA, you may not agree with it, but the governor can go ahead and do it in 45 days, that wouldn't be unconstitutional, too. It's just hard for me to get a wrap on that.
And that sounds like a comment more than a question, Representative Woodman.
Yeah, it probably is a comment more than a question.
All right. Just on that topic, Ms. Wallace, do you have a copy of the Kelly versus Hammond decision by Judge Stewart that you could forward to members of the committee? I suspect there's enough questions if you could forward it. But when you send the email, send it to the whole legislature. But if you have that available.
I will have to dig through our files. It's a Superior Court opinion from the 70s. I'm not looking at one in front of me, but I will see if I can find one. I'm pretty sure I can, so I will be happy to distribute once I have that.
Okay. I knew it was not from the Supreme Court, and it's not in any of the published mm-hmm. volumes, but it sounded like you'd had a chance to review it. So some of us that like to wander around in the weeds like to read the opinions, too. Okay, I think that gets us past question E. That gets us on to question F.
Okay, so the next question is 3707080H the only applicable statute to this issue? What other statute apply? So with respect to the RPL process, 3707080H is the primary statute at issue. I will note, though, that if you've had the opportunity to review RPLs that come before the LBNA committee, they all have a kind of a standard form that they utilize. And one of the boxes that the administration completes is appropriation authority. And so in that section, the executive branch identifies the specific appropriation item that it's seeking to increase. In other words, they give you the page and line of the operating budget that the RPL is seeking to increase. The other item that is on the RPL form is a box that lists the statutory authority, and the statutory authority is not the 370708OH component. It's the statutory authority generally for the agency or program that is under consideration, what their authority is to move forward and expend those funds. So depending on the specific RPL that you are reviewing or concerning, there might be other statutory provisions that that get analyzed. As I mentioned briefly before, you know, it has been my office's historical advice and opinions that the RPL process is not a process that can be utilized to amend the purpose of an appropriation made by the full legislature. So you might look at the underlying purpose of the appropriation sought to be increased and whether or not that agency has the statutory authority to move forward or undertake the expenditure that's being proposed. I know that's very broad, but that's just some general information in terms of the analysis that goes into each of the RPLs that are submitted by the executive branch. And also, it's not customary for legal to, or not, I shouldn't say customary, but legislative legal is not necessarily involved in analyzing each and every RPL that comes to Ledge Finance from OMB. You know, Ledge Legal, someone will ask us for an opinion if there's a question or if the RPL raises potentially any legal issues. And so there are, it would not be unusual for an RPL to come to Ledge Finance from OMB that is for a program and a purpose that has RPLs are traditionally or customarily used for, meaning that there's nothing out of the ordinary about that RPL. Someone may not ask legal for an interpretation or analysis of the RPL because it doesn't raise any issues. The next sub-question for that, for question F, is how does the 45-day period apply in the current situation where the legislative session is not over, but the legislature is in recess? And so one of the questions that has been, or one of the issues that I've had is, you know, the appropriateness of the RPL process while the legislature is in session versus during the interim. So the RPL process has traditionally been utilized during the interim when the legislature is not in session. However, I don't have any specific circumstances, but it's my general anecdotal knowledge that the RPL process has been utilized while the legislature is in session previously, maybe not under similar circumstances, but it has been done before. And the RPL statute 370708OH does not specifically provide a time frame for when the process can be utilized and when it can't. LBNA has the statutory authority to meet, even though it's a permanent interim committee, it has the power to meet, you know, during session and out of session. And so I think in these particular circumstances, in light of the unprecedented scenario where we're at, where the legislature did pass each of its, well, with the exception of the capital budget, you know, the legislature passed its appropriation measures before it went into an indefinite recess, and the legislature has not yet announced a date certain when it might reconvene. It's my opinion that utilization of the RPL process at this point, while the legislature is in recess, does not, a court would likely not invalidate any action by the LBNA committee because the legislature is technically in session. Like I said, the legislature has passed its appropriation bills, and the RPL process can be used to increase an appropriation once the legislature has passed its appropriation measures. So I don't have any legal, or I don't have any objection to utilization of the process. It's an open question, but I find it unlikely that a court would invalidate any action taken by LBNA while the legislature's at recess. The 45-day wait period, though, that doesn't hinge at all in terms of whether the legislature is at recess or whether the legislature is in session. I haven't recently gone back and looked at the legislative history for the LBNA 45-day wait period, but it's my general understanding that part of the reason the 45-day wait period is there is to allow the legislature the opportunity to reconvene if it finds it necessary to specifically appropriate those funds or take other action. And I think that sums it up for that section. If there's no questions, I can move into
a little bit. You can go ahead and go through the other two questions. I know you touched on the catch-all provisions already, but we're going to try to hold most questions off till the end.
Okay. So the next question is, how does the catch-all appropriation language and the operating budget impact the RPL analysis? And as I already mentioned, the impact of the catch-all provision is that it appropriates the language or the additional receipts conditioned on compliance with 3707-080H. You know, the catch-all language, just like the RPL statute itself, has never been the subject of litigation. And so the constitutionality of the catch-all language has never been reviewed by the Alaska Supreme Court. Generally, there are two elements to any appropriation, the first element being that, you know, the amount appropriated must be stated or ascertainable, and that there is a and then the second is that there is a purpose of the appropriation that must also be stated or ascertainable. Someone might argue that the catch-all is too broad because it doesn't provide an ascertainable appropriation, but you know, the other side of that issue is that so long as the RPL process is complied with, that additional increased amount is an ascertainable increase to the appropriation. The catch-all language, and I'll just read it briefly, It has on occasion changed. The legislature has on occasion added certain receipts that are exempted from the RPL process. In other words, the legislature has contemplated that it does not want to allow certain appropriations to be increased through the RPL process. So On occasion, the legislature has added restrictive language in this section, but generally it reads that federal or other program receipts that exceed the amounts appropriated in this act are appropriated conditioned upon compliance with the program review provisions of AS 3707-080H. So that language says that federal or other program receipts that exceed amounts appropriated in this act. So to fulfill one of the appropriation elements, the RPL that is seeking to be increased must be for the purpose of the appropriation that is seeking to be increased. An alternative interpretation of that, I suppose, could be that the catch-all appropriation authorizes expenditures for any function that the recipient agency may statutorily undertake, but it's my opinion that a court would not be persuaded to give that broad interpretation, and that the RPL process can only be utilized to increase an existing appropriation item for the same purpose identified in the original appropriation. Moving on to the last question, was, can a single RPL be used to increase the expenditure in more than one fiscal year? This goes back again to the specific language in 3707-080H, which says that the increase of an appropriation item may be made. And so this issue was raised with respect to the current RPLs that the governor put forward with respect to expenditure of the CARES Act. Quite a few of the RPLs that were proposed by the governor sought multi-year expenditure authority, and one of the issues that I raised with those RPLs is that, you know, unless you specifically identify how much the appropriation is to be increased in each fiscal year, it would be improper to just categorically request to spend money over multiple fiscal years. In other words, if you have $100,000 or $100 million RPL request and you're asked to spend it, you know, between FY20 and FY21, that doesn't sufficiently indicate how much you are increasing your FY20 expenditure and appropriation, and how much you're increasing your FY21 appropriation, and therefore it didn't to not specify would not comply with the RPL procedure. Based on some conversations that Ledge Finance and OMB were able to have, those issues were largely cured with the administration's submission of a new batch of RPLs that were submitted on May 1st, and the RPLs that were approved by LBNA on May 1st, several of those had multi-year expenditure requests, and the revised RPLs each provided how much money was to be expended in FY20 versus FY21. And then the other kind of nuance to that issue is that just depending on the agency and the specific appropriation, the operating budgets do contain carry forward language for certain appropriations, meaning that if there's leftover federal receipts in FY20, there's a specific appropriation language that says that those receipts carry over to FY20. And so because the administration sufficiently identified how much was to be spent in each year, that cured the legal issues surrounding expenditures over more than one fiscal year. And I think that's it.
Thank you much, very much. Are there members of the committee either in the room or online that have questions for Ms. Wallace? Questions? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace. Your legal memo of April 30, referring to the RPL promise and 45-day wait period to the LBNA committee chair, has any of your opinion based on any new information or understanding changed with respect to the RPLs that deal with community assistance payments, the small business relief, or the economic stimulus for Alaskan fisheries? Your legal guidance at that time was that these would require legislative action and that the RPLs dealing with statewide airports and the Whittier Access and Tunnel, there appeared to be insufficient authority and would likely be found improper. So I know you've covered a lot of ground. Just wondering if your legal view on those issues had evolved at all.
And just for clarity for those that have the documents, there's actually two legal research memos dated April 30th that Ms. Wallace provided to the LBNA chair. One is a two-page memo that specifically talks about the 45-day period, and I believe Representative Kopp is actually talking about the eight-page memo that addresses several different RPLs, just to make sure everybody's looking to the same ones. Go ahead, Ms. Wallace.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kopp. So as part of the May 1st RPL submissions, the administration updated or revised the particularly there was a I don't know if the word substantial is appropriate, but they did revise the community assistance RPLs. The community assistance RPLs, and I don't have them in front of me, but the amount was reduced to $200,000, and that's not, it might be $250,000, but it's $200,000-something as opposed to the $562,000. And some of the, I had gone through the different components of the RPL, and so the statutory authority that was cited has been revised to point to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development general departmental authority to administer grants and federal community assistance programs. So there's been some revision to the statutory authority that's been cited. But the general conclusion about the appropriateness of utilizing the RPL process has not, my opinion has not changed in that regard. The formula that appears to have been utilized to determine the amount that each local government or community will get, it's my understanding that formula was slightly changed to provide a little bit more assistance to a few different communities, but that the formula in general did not change. But there still remains no statutory authority, in my opinion, that provides the governor the authority to develop or create a new community assistance payment formula, as is used or proposed in the RPL. The small business relief RPL has been also modified. It no longer includes a proposal to utilize AHFC as part of the small business loans. It now exclusively, to utilize the DCCED authority in cooperation with ADA, and but again, my general conclusion on that one has not changed, and I'm not sure that any information really was updated on the fisheries RPL, and so the conclusion on that RPL has not changed either.
Thank you. I don't see other questions. Just for my own clarity, when we talk about an appropriation, I think we can all agree that in the 2020 budget that we're currently in, when we passed that last year, we didn't make any appropriations that were specific to COVID-19. And there are specific appropriations in the 2021 budget for COVID-19. Does that mean from a standpoint of the appropriations that it's your general analysis that because there is no appropriation for COVID-19 in 2019 that the legislature would need to make the appropriation, there would be no appropriation to increase for COVID-19 in the 2020 budget through the RPL process, whereas if there's appropriations in the 2021 budget process for COVID-19, the RPL process would be appropriate to make those adjustments. And if somebody's got their mute off, please put it back on.
Mr. Chair, so you're correct. There was obviously, before any of this happened, you know, the legislature passed its FY 2020 budgets. Although the legislature did pass an FY 2020 supplemental budget, one of the strictest readings, in my opinion, of 3707080H is that if the legislature didn't appropriate any CARES Act funds, then there are no appropriations, you know, eligible to be increased. But if you take a little bit less restrictive of a reading, you could, you know, get to a point where you it's permissible to allow an appropriation that does have some federal receipt authority to be utilized through the RPL process to increase that appropriation to allow for expenditures of these CARES Act funds, so long as the purpose of that appropriation is consistent with the purpose for utilization of the CARES Act funds. And, one of the examples, the RPLs that were approved, for example, on May 1st by LBNA, particularly I'm kind of thinking about the education RPLs for education funding. You know, the Department of Education and Education already have federal receipt authority, and the purpose and the scope of the RPL was consistent with the underlying appropriation, meaning that they were going to carry out the same purpose and the same function, just the amount was going to be increased in light of the additional federal receipts that came available through the CARES Act. Now, there were still some restrictions on use of those funds, as part of the restrictions that came with the funds from the federal government, but ultimately the purposes matched there. And so, in my opinion, there was not a legal issue with utilizing the RPL process even for an FY20 appropriation in that circumstance. Some of these other RPLs are a little bit different of a situation because the purpose of the appropriations sought to be increased are not as compatible as the previous education example that I gave.
So by way of example, we currently get federal receipts that help support school lunches, and to the extent that through the CARES Act there's more money for food going to schools, then it's appropriate to increase that because it's still the same purpose, it's just more money coming in. But there's already an appropriation for school lunches that appropriates both state dollars and federal dollars.
Exactly.
And then in contrast to that, the community revenue sharing, there's never been a federal component of the community revenue sharing, and in addition, there's actually no budget for revenue sharing. So with both of those things in that place, there's no federal receipt authority for those. So even if there were money to be used for revenue sharing from the federal funds, there's no appropriation for that in the budget. And that's why, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that's the reason why you're saying your opinion hasn't changed about the revenue sharing.
Through the chair, generally correct. So the appropriation that has been identified for the community revenue sharing is an appropriation to the division of community and regional affairs, and the purpose of that appropriation is not to carry out a community assistance function. It generally just funds the operations of that division. And so, therefore, in my opinion, the purpose of that appropriation is not to carry out a community assistance function. And not only do we not have a federal component to any existing community assistance program, but we don't have a formula that distributes, these funds in this manner for a community assistance program, because, the RPL does not rely exclusively on the community assistance formula that's set out in 2960, 850 through 879. It also includes a component of, I believe, sales tax or other tax revenue based on information that DCCED collects for municipalities. That all that information went into establishing a new criteria or new formula for distribution to communities.
Then I want to touch basic back on the 45-day requirement in the 3707.080 subsection H. It appears that in a scenario either where the LBNA committee doesn't take action in the 45-day period or they take action and say we don't want to give the authority to the governor, what that 45-day window essentially is allowing the legislature to do is we would either go back in from recess or in another scenario call ourselves back in and specifically not allow the governor to have that fund, because the theory, I think, would be if the catch-all makes it that the governor has access to, say, $100 million, the governor could spend that unless the legislature itself comes back in and says no. If, in contrast, the LBNA committee approves that, then the governor can spend it earlier, but he can't spend it. But without LBA concurrence, he has to wait 45 days, and the 45 days is to give the legislature a chance to come in and say, no, we're really not going to let you spend the money that that you could be allowed to spend through the catch-all. No, that's a kind of complicated question.
The 45-day wait period certainly it allows the legislature the opportunity to reconvene. Obviously, there's a lot of policy decisions that the legislature could make in terms of what action it takes, you know, if it reconvenes. It may be just to explicitly approve the recommendations for expenditure as proposed, or as you mentioned, formulate a new way to appropriate the funds or take other action.
Okay, thank you. Any other members of the committee with questions for Ms. Wallace? Representative Cobb.
Ms. Wallace, did you have a chance to look at the original bill file from this 1979 law? We keep, you know, referring back to AS 3707-080H. I was just thinking about the committee minutes and discussion around that, because we're getting into some matters of, you know, interpretation and how much wiggle room there is. And just curious if we've pulled that file and looked at some of the dialogue in the process, or if you think that would be helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I haven't recently done that. We certainly could. That might come, you know, it might be relevant if there were a challenge to the process to have an understanding of what that legislative history is, and, you know, whether or not the court looks at that legislative history, you know, would just kind of depend upon whether or not the court, you know, found there to be any ambiguity or concern with the plain language of the statute. But I'm happy to work with our librarians and pull some of that history from the 1979 enactment to pass on to members of the committee.
Thank you, and through the chair. I think
follow-up is fine.
I think, you know, kind of one of the fundamental issues we're wrestling with is getting this urgently needed funding out to the communities and industries impacted, doing it in the most lawful manner possible and not risking legal upheaval after the fact. And so I asked the question just in the spirit of helping not only the legislature but the administration coming to consensus on the best way forward that is most defensible and in the best interest of all Alaskans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't have any other questions. Representative Ledoux, you've had a number of questions. I'll specifically ask, I don't see a text from me. Do you have any additional questions, Representative Ledoux?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
And I'll just, Representative Vance, any questions for you for Ms. Wallace?
Not at this time. Thank you.
And Representative Shaw is out. Representative Stutes, I know you were having some phone difficulties. Representative Stutes, if you're online, do you have any questions for Ms. Wallace? I think she may have gotten bumped out by power outages in Kodiak. And Representative Drummond, any questions for Ms. Wallace?
No, thank you, Representative Klayman. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I don't see any other questions. I want to thank members of the committee. I want to thank other members of the legislature who have taken time to call in. Ms. Wallace, thank you. That's a long haul, and you did on a yeoman's task going through with a lot of detail and answering a number of detailed questions. With that, I'm going to close invited testimony. We will now adjourn for the day. We have no committee meeting scheduled at the current time in the next several days, but to the extent that something comes up, we'll certainly get notice on under the 24-hour rule. Thank you all for taking the time to meet today. This meeting is adjourned. It is now 11:45 a.m.